He, prior to his legal training, he received his BA from Amherst College in 1995 and his law degree from LSU Law Center in 1998. He was employed with Fisher & Phillips in New Orleans, primarily in the areas of labor and employment litigation. He has since moved to DeQuerre & Clark, where his father is the partner. And he is the only, as far as I know, the only family where all three sons, my three sons, are all lawyers. Two of them with the firm, and another, the baby son, as I call him, works with Taylor Porter Brooks and Phillips and Baton Rouge. So I bring to you Winston DeQuerre, Jr.
Thank you, Dr. Brumfield. Well, it's good to be here again. Just as background, I was up here in April for a judicial affairs conference, and I was back, I guess, 2 or 3 months ago for a small session with the Faculty Senate, and now I'm back again today for a session that's open to the whole faculty. If I repeat some things, each group had a different group attending. I apologize in advance. At the outset, I just want to point out our firm is the outside counsel to the University of Louisiana system. What that means is we provide legal advice to the Board of Supervisors governing all of the campuses within the University of Louisiana system. Frequently, probably more often than not, we provide legal advice straight to the heads of the campuses because most of the problems, or I shouldn't say problems, most of the issues that require the attention of a lawyer are generated at the campus level rather than the system level. So I'm out here quite a bit. But I say that because you have to understand my job is to represent my client. My client is the University of Louisiana system and the administration that runs the campuses. I can answer questions in the generic, which is what I'm here to do. By in the generic, I can tell you what laws, what rules, where they are governing just about any specific situation that occurs on a campus. Just as a background, our firm handles all kinds of things, from the third-party financing with the new apartments and suites you're seeing put up to, you know, discrimination issues involving students or faculty and just about everything in between. So there's usually something I know about most things that occur on a college campus. Now, I'm sure you see all this stuff here. I don't intend to go through all of it because I was told this was supposed to be an interactive discussion. When I get to lead a lecture, I need a very small stack of papers. When I'm just going to answer questions most of the time, I'm overly cautious, so I bring all types of stuff on all types of topics because I can't be for certain what might come up. But the issues, just at the outset, that I did bring some material on in case you don't have questions but you'd like to hear some updates before I go to the questions I was asked, include employment topics such as wage payment, harassment, background checks, searches and seizures, copyright infringement, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, some due process issues, as well as the tenure and handbook and contract issues that were sent to me earlier this week. Has anybody heard me talk about any of those other issues at previous lectures? Raise your hand so I'll know who's... Okay, so a few of y'all have, so I may not repeat some of that stuff. Before I get to these questions, one really recent topic I'd like to start off with is the Supreme Court. Why would you guys care about the Supreme Court? Anybody? Wild guess? Well, what? United States Supreme Court. Very recently, this spring term, the United States Supreme Court decided a case that I spoke about earlier this year. It was Jackson versus City of Birmingham. I don't know if you remember it. It was a Title IX case. It was a case involving whether a women's head basketball coach who was male had a retaliation cause of action under Title IX for discrimination because of sex. Why was this unique? Title IX does not have a retaliation cause of action built into it. It just doesn't say it. It's not like Title VII or Title VI, where if you retaliate under this, you're automatically, you know, you go to court and all these bad things happen and you get money. Title IX doesn't have this. So this case got appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. It was a Title IX retaliation cause of action. And the court said that he had a claim. Title IX should be read very broadly to mean discrimination because of sex. And that includes complaining because of sex. Well, what was the most important thing about this case was the number 5. there were five people who supported the opinion and four who voted against it. And the five who supported it were Ginsburg, Stevens, Souter, Breyer, and
O'Connor,
the one who resigned. Very important because O'Connor has traditionally viewed education statutes very liberally. That's often good for the schools or bad for the schools, depending on which side you're on. But having an appointment to replace O'Connor could mean something for education cases in the next Supreme Court term. So we've been following the Supreme Court very closely. Some of the decisions we've seen coming out where O'Connor literally wrote the opinion because she was the swing vote, you now look at this opinion and decide if it's Alito, not O'Connor, what happens to this Title IX case? Does the male head of a women's basketball team no longer have a cause of action just because there's a different vote as the swing vote? So that's just sort of some tidbits with the Supreme Court that's going on right now. Now to your questions. Any order?
Not particularly. With the budget cuts that are going on now, I suppose it matters of employment security, you know, reduction in force, program discontinuation, and so on.
Okay. Well, and you have all those.
Yeah, there
are all those in here. Let me back up and say some general statements. There's a couple ways budget cuts. Any of y'all familiar with the state's budget or how it works? Appropriations through committee to the anybody? Okay, I'm gonna start a few. I'm gonna start at the background. The state has a couple ways to adjust a budget. One of the things you've heard is a possible reduction in hours within the civil service system. That's one way to reduce a budget. Another way to reduce a budget is to give an agency a mandate that your budget needs to be this much smaller for a given period of time. Both of those require legislative action. The difference is, in the former situation, you don't have much choice how you reduce your budget. An agency like civil service says, we're gonna do this to these employees, and we're gonna try to reduce civil service costs by maybe reducing the number of hours each employee works over a certain period. You may have heard they use terms such as furlough or cutting back to 30 or 35 hour weeks, those things. If you're simply given a reduced budget, such as the University of Louisiana system, instead of looking line by line through the employees, the state just says, we need you to cut 5% out of your budget. That's an entirely different type of budget cut. That's a budget cut that the board of the University of Louisiana system gets to basically decide where in its budget does it want to try to reduce expenditures, which eventually trickles down to each campus. And the campus administration ultimately has to decide, well, if we have to make our appropriate percentage cut, they have some flexibility in deciding where on each campus do we have to reduce our expenditures. Right now, we're not sure how budgets are going to be cut, if at all, in higher education. There's been some talk about reducing higher education budgets, but nobody can give you any definite answers on what the reduction is going to be, what the amount's going to be, or how it's going to be cut until the legislature votes and, you know, the special session starts this Sunday. And as of me leaving my office on Thursday, actually I left Tuesday to go out of town, only two bills had been pre-filed. Just for your background, one involved insurance and the other involved the registry of dislocated sex offenders. That's what the legislators thought was important, I guess. But those are the only two bills that had been filed as of, I think it was Monday afternoon, Tuesday. It was an insurance bill and registry of sex offenders. The potential amendment of the budget hadn't been filed yet, so I'm not sure how it's going to be done. Now, stepping forward, one hypothetical. Let's suppose the budget's reduced by the numbers we're hearing people talk about is 5 to 10%, and we don't know what agencies it's going to hit, but let's just suppose the budget's reduced by 5 to 10%. What does that mean for U of L? Well, to decide what it means for U of L, you have to determine, you know, if the U of L system as a whole is handed a 5 to 10% budget reduction, it will be the authority of the board to determine, you know, how that budget reduction is handled across the entire system. And the board will be the one to tell each campus, this is what we need you to do to reduce your budget. And there really, you know, it isn't much input from you guys at that time. That's strictly a board decision. Once it comes to the campus, then the campus administration will be responsible for, you know, basically going through the budget and deciding, you know, what can be done to make our expenditures meet what we've been told by our governing board in order to meet the budget. Now, all of that is done. Notice I did not use the famed word, financial exigency. All of that is done, not necessarily with a declaration of financial exigency. Budgets are reduced all the time without a declaration of financial exigency. Financial exigency is something that is completely separate from simple budget reductions. When you hear talk of a budget reduction, it doesn't mean, boom, financial exigency, all bets are off. It means budgets have to be reduced. What a financial exigency is, for those of you who are interested, I have a policy site. I did not memorize this stuff, I apologize. It was very, very lengthy. Let me get it for you here. I'm about to read it to you if you want. It's all on the internet. Thought I had it highlighted, I apologize. It's actually in section 3 of the board rules on faculty and staff. And there's a procedure for financial exigency. Now, with financial exigency, I'm going to shift and come back real quick. You've got to discuss program elimination. And that was another question. Now, program elimination or program discontinuance is board policy. It's Roman numeral 3.Roman numeral 15.B-1. And it's also on the same internet site with the site for financial exigency. And I didn't find the exact paragraph on financial exigency. Now, the way they work together is if the board declares a financial exigency, it gives the board some discretion to determine how and in what manner it reduces costs. And that can mean elimination or reduction of tenured staff, elimination or reduction of just about anybody on the campus. What a financial exigency is it's a situation where the board has recognized that it cannot cover its expenses in the current manner they are, given the budget it's received from the state and other sources. Now, there's an interesting note to financial exigency. The period of financial exigency lasts for a year. And here it is here. It's actually when I told you it was chapter 3, it's paragraph K, is termination for financial exigency. Everybody got that? Now, I call it program elimination, but I'm trying to figure out the exact word here. Program discontinuance and financial exigency reduction in force work like this. A program can be discontinued as a result of a financial exigency. People can be discontinued as a result of financial exigency. Program discontinuance has two branches. It has an internal method of discontinuance, and there's an external method of discontinuance. Similar to what I told you about employees, early on, before we talked about financial exigency, you can limit costs by having the state externally reduce hours employees work, or internally, the campus as its own unit can figure out how it reduces employee costs by cutting hours of work or employees. Well, when you have program discontinuance, you can have a program discontinued from an internal review, one starting at the campus level, or from an external review. The external review would be one starting at the Board of Regents level, not the University of Louisiana board level. That would be considered internal. If you look at program discontinuance does not necessarily require a declaration of financial exigency. Program discontinuance can be initiated simply by someone at the campus level, such as a president or a vice president. And within the policy, when a program is reviewed for discontinuance at the campus level, it does not occur by surprise. There's some provisions in the policy that provide for input from faculty, especially tenured faculty, in making the decision to discontinue a particular program. Now, when I say input from faculty, does it mean the faculty can stop a program discontinuance? No. I'm not going to sit here and tell you you have the ability to stop a program discontinuance. But according to the policy, the faculty will be consulted and they will have input in the evaluation of a program for discontinuance. If a program is discontinued externally, there will be notification to the faculty and its possible input. Basically, the administration can't force, or the faculty can't force their ideas upon the Board of Regents. Ideally, the Board of Regents will seek input from the faculty and the administration at a campus before they discontinue the program. But when you start from top down, it's a very different scenario than when you start from bottom up. Program discontinuance can occur for any number of reasons. If there is a financial exigency, for example, there may be evaluation of programs that haven't had graduates in a long time, programs that have very low numbers of graduates. It's really up to the administration or the Board of Regents as to how they review particular programs for discontinuance. Going back again to the budget, if the campus is handed a mandate to reduce its budget by a certain amount, any possible program discontinuance would start from the bottom up, because it would be the campus looking at how can we fit our campus budget within the budget we were provided from our governing board. And so you would have input on that. If the system gets a mandate from the Board of Regents to reduce certain programs because of XYZ factors, don't blame the campus. I mean, their hands are going to be tied in that situation, and they're simply going to be required to provide notice. If a program's discontinued, there is some protection for the faculty. Have any of you looked at the program discontinuance policy? Okay. There's one person. This stuff is on the internet. It's not a bad idea in your spare time to take a glance at it, look at this stuff, because there are some protections for the faculty. One is they have to be provided notice. They have to be provided a year's notice prior to the beginning of the academic year that the program is going to be discontinued. And then there are some obligations to work with the faculty to assist them in possibly taking positions in other departments that aren't going to be discontinued. So it's not just like, you know, on March 29th, the university can send a letter and say, boom, English department is closed, thank you very much. It doesn't work like that under the policy. There are some notice provisions. It's one of these things that will not happen by absolute surprise, especially if it started internally, because the procedure internally has provisions for faculty participation. Anybody have any questions about program discontinuance?
But you said that especially as it starts internally, if it starts externally, it's different.
If it starts externally, you will still get the notice, but your ability to input won't be as great as it will when it starts internally. Because external factors for program discontinuance are going to be very different from internal factors from program discontinuance. When you do an internal review, I mean, basically, the administration on this campus with input from you guys are going to look at programs that, for whatever reason, you know, it just may not be feasible to keep those programs up and running. Externally, the Board of Regents, they can look at every college under their jurisdiction in the state and make an evaluation as to which programs we need to fund at which campuses, which may be very different from the way you look at it. And so your input is going to be very different if it's an external program discontinuous than if it's an internal program discontinuous.
Would the timing be the same?
The timing would probably be the same. You'd still get the 1 year notice. I mean, you wouldn't get a discontinuance any faster. It's just the ability for faculty input would be very different.
You said probably.
Probably. No, it's still you would still get the 1 year notice. You would still get the 1 year notice.
Where on the internet is
the program discontinuance is on the University of Louisiana system website. Under faculty and staff, there's a separate section for PPM, policy and procedure.
Yep.
None of this stuff is a secret. This isn't like some secret website access. The lawyer has a special code he can put in, and I get these special policies nobody gets to see. I'm paid to spend my time keeping track of them. It's really the only difference. But anybody in the internet accessible public, and if you're not in the internet accessible public, they're available in print for anybody to review. So none of this stuff I'm reading you guys is a secret.
These are in the PPM
section? These are, when I call out the numbers, I'm giving you the PPM number. Okay. So unlike me, you don't have to go through 800 of them to find, you know, all kinds of policies on everything under the sun to find just the one you're looking for. I'm calling out the ones I referenced, so I'll make it a little quicker. You had a question? Now, that's program discontinuance. Let's talk about people, actual people. And I hate to use people discontinuous, but termination. People discontinuous. No, termination. That was not a funny joke on the front row. But people discontinuous. Within the faculty, some of the stuff I know is going to be, you guys probably know as well, if not better than I do. You've got different ranks of professors. You've got instructors. Then you've got untenured faculty. Then you've got tenured faculty. If you take the middle category, your untenured faculty, I'm assuming they can possibly be in the ranks, although your tenured are going to be your associate and your fulls. Your untenured would probably be your assistant professors. And then you have this interesting group, your continuing but not tenure track appointments. Okay? Everybody follow? People are familiar with those general categories? Yes? No? You are? Okay. I thought I saw a no. Those are the general categories. In terms of rank, I view them categorically. You've got your instructors, your continuing appointments that are not tenure track, sort of the same level at the bottom. Then you have your tenure track probationary, and then you have your tenured. Everybody follow? And nobody's surprised by that stratification of your faculty. For termination of your instructors and your continuing appointments but not tenure track, it's simply a notification. It's simply a notification. When you're in those categories, you're given an appointment for a specific term, and the ULM faculty handbook has a provision for when you have to be notified if your contract is not going to be renewed at the expiration of that term. And that is, I have that in here too. I really should have tabbed these better. Actually, I don't have a page. It's actually on the ULM website, but there are not page numbers or section numbers on the faculty handbook provisions that I printed out. It just starts introduction. The dates are generally March, if you're within 1 year, and I believe it's December of the previous year if you've been working more than a year.
Let me ask you, because you apparently made a statement in your August presentation
Yeah.
that the faculty handbook is not binding.
No, and I'm coming back to that. I'm
wondering what good it is to reference the handbook.
I'm coming back to that. Here it is. It's actually termination of faculty appointments. If you're within your first year, it has to be March 1, and then it's 1 year's notice if you've been working for more than a year. And that is for your non-tenured faculty provisions. Now, what does this mean? This faculty handbook, and it just says there's no chapter or page number here, this faculty handbook does not form a contract. It's not like when you sign your faculty appointment, this handbook creates additional terms and conditions of that contract that aren't written into it or of that letter of appointment. But what it does create is you do have some rights to, you do have some property interest in the expectations created in the faculty handbook that can't be changed without proper notice. And let's take this termination provision. If you've been appointed in a temporary or an instructor position and you've been working a year, if you're not going to be renewed, you have to be told by March 1, okay? On March 5th, they can't change this policy and suddenly send you the notice because you had a property interest in your job and you had an expectation that that notice was going to come by March 1. You follow? On March 5th, they can change this policy and make it anytime they want, but it's going to apply to you the following year. There are certain policies that create an expectation and you get a property interest in. Those policies can still be changed without faculty input, they just require notice. Everyone follow? Many of the policies don't create a property interest. They just aren't related to something that's considered under the law a property interest, something that's tangible like your earnings or your rank or your pay or your seniority. Those policies can be changed at any time. You just have to be given notice. And those policies can be changed by the administration or the board. There's a couple ways the policies can be changed. Everyone follow that? Okay. So for your bottom two levels of faculty, financial exigency is neither here nor there because their contracts can be terminated by notice. If you're in those categories, you really don't, it's not worth a whole lot to worry about financial exigency because if a really, really bad day comes and a financial exigency is declared, or even before a financial exigency is declared, one would think that the system would just start sending out those notices since they have the power to do so, that these contracts aren't going to be renewed. Their status isn't going to be made any better or worse off by financial exigency because their contracts can be terminated by notice. Now, for your tenured faculty, as you know, I'm sure you're all familiar with, just in the ordinary setting, the reasons and ways you can remove a tenured faculty member, right? You get the collective nod up and down. Okay. What does financial exigency do to that? All it does is really overlay a procedure on top whereby the administration can look at reducing tenured faculty members, that is, reductions in force or terminations, based upon the budget. However, in that termination policy, the administration also has to look at the termination of non-tenured faculty and instructors, the termination of staff and administrators, and other places in the budget where money can be eliminated. So it really doesn't, financial exigency is a method that can be used to consider the termination of tenured staff, but the ULM policy provides for the university to consider, you know, basically everything else in addition to that as at the time it makes that decision. Any questions? I know that's a mouthful, and that was a very lawyerly mouthful on purpose, but that's basically what happens.
So is it in addition to, or is it before?
There's not a precedent. It's in a I have the list here. It's not a precedent to terminating faculty. It's an in addition to. And the policy is policy statement for possible reduction in faculty, and it's on the ULM website, and it says reduction. There's no page number. It just says reduction policy HTML. But it's on the ULM website. And basically what it says is it says, you know, you have to consider, you know, and it goes through the list I gave you. Then it says, you know, you consider seniority, and you consider seniority status among non-tenured faculty if they're going to be forced to undergo a reduction in force also. So it has these criteria that will be evaluated before you just, you know, reduce tenured faculty. The Board of Supervisors of the University of Louisiana system has a similar policy. I mean, they're almost mirrors. What ULM has done is it's made a policy that mirrors the Board of Supervisors policy. Now, any questions about that? Now, in terms of notice, I know y'all look so bleak. I'm like, God, I wish I could say something to make people smile. In terms of notice, the one difference tenured faculty will have over your instructors and non-tenured faculty is that you will have notice of the financial exigency before the system would go wholesale into eliminating tenured faculty. Because of your tenure status, you're going to get, basically, you will see notices go out from the system and from the administration that these things will take place. The untenured faculty, they'll simply, I mean, even without a financial exigency, they can just get their normal timely notice that their contract's not going to be renewed. And that's all they'll get. So that's really what your tenure affords you is extra notice.
Is there a timeline for the tenure under exigency?
No.
Just tomorrow?
I mean, practically, I can't promise, but I can say practically it would never happen that fast. Because one of the things you've got to remember is, you know, you're running a university and you don't, you know, cut off your nose to spite your face, so to speak. So it wouldn't be that fast, but there would be plenty of warning for tenured faculty before somebody would use a financial exigency to start a reduction in force. Any questions about that? This went a lot faster than I was expecting. Let me go back to the list of questions here. And I will go through the questions.
Let me sort of rephrase part of what's in there regarding the faculty handbook. Mm-hmm. Our, as you observed, we don't have it well organized, at least in the way it appears on the web. But there also, it's considerably out of date. That is, the statements in the handbook don't agree with actual practice, actual policy that's been promulgated over recent years.
Okay.
So, what kind of a problem is that?
What's in the handbook?
Well, anybody think of a specific example? But.
Tenure promotion that can't be
promoted
if you're not tenured or tenured if
you're
not promoted.
Yeah, there's. Now I'm not sure whether that's addressed, whether it's at odds or just silent, and the handbook may be silent on that point. But I guess what we're wondering is, how does policy have to be published or propagated if it really constitutes a change to what's in the handbook, but the handbook itself has actually not been updated?
I know exactly what you're asking now. Going back to here, I did make one mistake. In the University of Louisiana policy, and I should mention this, it's actually Chapter 3, Chapter 3, Section 16 is the University of Louisiana Policy for Financial Exigency. I did make one mistake, and that's what I was looking for. There is a one-year notice period for tenured faculty members in the event of a financial exigency. And that is the largest difference between tenured faculty members and untenured faculty members, because they only have the 3 and 6 month notice period provided for in their letter of appointment, whether it's a financial exigency or not.
Is there a date by which tenured faculty must be notified?
It's 1 year. There's a 1 year notice period. So what's going to happen is whatever date you get the notice, the reduction has to occur the following year. You see what I'm saying?
It's a little confusing, but if you get it in March, does that mean next March you're gone, or does that
mean
the end of the following year?
There's actually, there's a legal debate, and I'm not going to opine on it here, that, you know, do faculty operate on a calendar year? So if you get a notice, does that mean it's good for the next calendar year, or is it good for the next academic year? There's a debate as to that right now, so I can't tell you.
Our appointments come by the school year.
Pardon me?
Our appointments come by the academic year.
And I would interpret this policy to mean you would get a 1 academic year notice prior to a reduction because of a financial exigency. It just says 1 year, though. And so I can't guarantee it's going to be 1 academic year, but it says 1 year. Yeah, who knows what? But it does say 1 year, and that is the biggest advantage of tenure over non-tenured status.
Listen, I can answer a little of that. In all the cases that I've read, exigency, there's a difference if you're in a private institution than a public one. But usually, the calendar year is the time that letter is sent. The clock starts. Because it doesn't matter where you are in the budget cycle. The budget cycle, we're halfway through our budget year. But that's what it is. Private institutions, the letter can come today, and you could be asked to leave tomorrow. That's just the difference between how policies work versus public and private higher education. That helps a lot.
And I'm going to correct myself again. The 1 year notice period goes to program discontinuance, not financial exigency. So flip it over one. That's where the 1 year comes in. Not financial exigency, it's program discontinuance. If you're curious, and I was going to read just a brief excerpt from the board's financial exigency policy. It basically provides a very detailed notice provision as to how notice will be sent to the faculty in the event of a financial exigency. And this is what I was trying to tell you. It won't be by surprise. There's a very detailed notice provision that the board has to follow. The notice has to be approved by the board. And then it says, and this is the part a lawyer would highlight, financial exigency shall terminate either at the end of the fiscal year or after 1 calendar year, depending upon the financial state of the institution at the end of the fiscal year. So financial exigency by policy is set up on a year-to-year basis. This financial exigency policy, although it can be continued year to year, doesn't contemplate declaring a financial exigency and come out of it 5 years later. This is something that's going to occur on a year-to-year basis. And if you look at the board policy, there's a very specific provision for how the notices will be transmitted, who's going to transmit them, how you'll receive them, all of that stuff. So none of this stuff will occur, so to speak, in some back office in Baton Rouge, and you guys will never hear about it until the notices appear in your boxes. I know that was about as clear as mud. Okay, we need to move on to something a little more exciting. Now, what protections do can non-tenured faculty have against dismissal?
Okay. Back to the handbook.
I know what I'm about.
The problem of maintaining handbook, how important that is, etc.
Yeah. Here's the whole, and I spent a lot of time in the handbook. I wish I'd tapped it a little better. The whole handbook issue for any school I've ever seen in the entire United States, and I've seen a bunch of them, is you have the Constitution of the United States, right? And the Constitution really outlines all due process requirements that the state owes individuals. And the state, by the state, I mean all state schools effectively act as the state. Then under the Constitution, you have every state tries to reiterate those requirements in its own state laws. And when it gets it wrong, it amends those state laws. Then every board of supervisors over a university, a state university, you know, has somebody who looks at those state laws and they try to craft easy to understand policies in compliance with those states' laws. So that you guys don't have to go to the state laws or the Constitution to see, you know, what the minimum due process rights are and other rights you should have. Then every campus tries to take those board policies and kind of, you know, rework them some to apply to this specific campus, but keep them consistent with the campus policies. They try to keep consistent with the board policies, with the state law, and with the Constitution up on top. Now, what starts to happen is the parts in the middle start getting amended and changing. You know, state laws will change, courts will interpret the Constitution differently, and then what you have happen is the system will start amending its bylaws given the latest legal decisions that have come out, so its bylaws comply with legal decisions. Well, at the bottom, at a campus level, the campus handbooks often aren't being updated as fast as the laws are changing or even the board bylaws are changing. And so frequently you get a situation where a handbook seems inconsistent with a practice that's going on. And a lot of that occurs because the practice often changes with the law. A lot of times, you know, a new decision will come down, like that Title IX decision, and I'll draft a form letter to the athletic director saying, you know, I've just seen this decision. We need to look at how to make sure we comply with this particular legal decision. Well, that's an instantaneous change in policy. But it's not really a change in policy because we didn't amend the handbook. That's just me advising somebody that, given this case, we need to look at complying with what this case says. Well, the handbook doesn't necessarily change, and because handbooks don't change all that frequently, and so frequently you wind up with policy and practices that don't agree with each other anymore. When that happens, the way we have to sort it out is basically the same way you get to the problem. You know, what are the minimum requirements under the law? You know, those always trump. State or federal, what does the law say has to be done in this situation? Then the board policy trumps the school policy. And then if the school policy isn't trumped by a board policy, that is the school policy is not inconsistent with the board policy, but it's still not being followed, we have to ask, why is this school policy not being followed? Is it because of some legal decision? Is it because someone thought the law was going to change and the law never changed? Is it because someone thought the board policy was going to change and it never changed? But we have to find out why. And if there's no good reason, you know what you do then. You got to get on the phone and tell somebody you need to follow the policy. I mean, it doesn't create a legal cause of action. It just creates a real bad problem. Because these handbooks don't create contracts. They may create property interest expectations, but they don't create contracts in the terms of, you know, you sign a contract and if I break this, you have a cause of action. It just creates a lot of confusion. So generally when you have a situation where something is being done differently from the way in a policy, 9 times out of 10 it's because it was supposed to be done differently and the policy never caught up. 1 time in 10, it's just because people like doing it differently. And if there's no legal impediment to doing it differently, you need to change the policy to make the policy consistent. If there's no reason we shouldn't be doing it under the old policy, then it's simply a matter of getting the practice back in conformance with the old policy. I'll give you a great, great, big, costly, very, very costly example of this problem. I represented a company many, many years ago when I was in private practice that had about 7,000 employees, all of which earned 15 vacation days a year. Now, the policy said you were to use all your vacation days. If not, they disappeared into nothingness, and you got 15 new vacation days on January 1 of the following year for use for the next year. Everybody understand how it works. The accounting department apparently didn't have some code on the computer to cause those vacation day numbers to never get above 15. So they grew and grew and grew and grew. And because accounting issued paychecks, every time somebody quit, they got this really big paycheck that no one ever paid attention to because it would zero out all those vacation days. Well, the company, you know, when one or two people let go a year and you got 7,000 employees, you don't really pay attention. But you want to do something like close a plant with 500 employees and you discover they got $2.5 million in vacation pay on the books and you've been paying it the last 10 years, it causes a real, real, real big problem. A problem that's very inconsistent with the policy you had written. And you have a choice. You know, you either... Those employees had no legal right to that time, but did we want to get in a massive lawsuit and fight over it? And so we had to work our way out of it. But in situations where your practice is inconsistent with your policy, you really need to let somebody know, because somebody needs to do the background to figure out why are we doing it differently from our handbook. If there's a valid reason, then it's just a matter of catching the handbook up to date with the practice. If it's not a valid reason, then you really have to ask yourself, should we go back to doing it like the handbook says? And that's the best way to solve that. But there's no real legal cause of action. And a lot of people, it happens all the time. People will pick some random policy and say, this was violated, I'm going to file a suit. And, you know, 6 months later, the suit's dismissed, and the only thing that's happened is people have spent a lot of dollars doing a lot of stuff to get to the same place, you know, kind of to run a big, big circle. And start at the beginning. Is there a question?
Let me ask Judy or anybody else who needs to leave soon, did you have anything else you wanted to ask about? Or? Okay.
Your letter of intent is important, because don't read what it doesn't contain, but read what it does contain. It usually contains a salary. Some do, some don't. You receive?
Yeah.
So your letter of intent basically says, you know, when you come to work, this is your salary. I mean, you really have to look for what does it state. And those things are binding. The other thing is, depending on what position it puts you into, the notice provisions, the 3 and 6 month notification for termination provisions, are also binding. You didn't hear those? What?
There are no promises.
What?
There are no promises contained.
No, actually, I said depending on what position you're appointed to. What's going to happen is if your letter of intent, and I don't want to know any specific facts, but let's say, for example, if your letter of intent is for instructor, right? It's just going to be an appointment to the position of instructor at the salary, right? Follow? Yes? Okay. Please nod. I feel like you're hearing me. So you just get this letter of intent. It says you're going to be, this is a letter of intent to appoint you at this salary to this position of instructor in this department. Okay. Yes, we all agree. Then you go to this, and you've got these termination provisions for instructor. And it says if you're in your first year and your letter of intent is not going to be renewed, you'll be notified by March 1. Now, that's not in the letter of intent, but that's in here. And you have to understand how they work together. If you're subsequent to your first year, you're going to be notified in December, so you effectively have 6 months' notice if your letter of intent is not going to be renewed. Do you follow? And so those are the parts that the school has to comply with. So it'd be a lot easier if they put that in the letter of intent, but it's a lot easier to change this than all the letters of intent. So the letter of intent by default, based on the position, will incorporate the termination provisions in this handbook. And so those are the parts that are binding. You know, when you're appointed to a position that in the handbook it says, if you're not going to be renewed, it'll be notified by a certain date. The school has an obligation to notify you by a certain date that your appointment's not going to be renewed. You follow what's Does that clear up anything? Yeah, okay. Any other questions like that? I'm going to keep going.
I have a question about that same. What about statements like in the letter of your renewal or whatever it is, that if you signed it, you were having to agree to perform certain duties and so forth, and then a clause like, and anything else that the administration thinks might be good for you to do. That is fine when you sign, you disagree and whatever they want to do with me, that's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had a longer answer for you, but that's a very simple yes. Most schools, if they're appointing anybody to do anything, they don't want to be bound by a specific job description. Basically, if you list three bullet points, say, we're appointing you in this position to do these three bullet point things, and something happens, and we really need to pay you to do these things that weren't in the letter, then what you have is, this is not what I'm here to do this year. I'm not doing it. So a lot of institutions put those, we call them blanket paragraphs, put those blanket paragraphs at the bottom so that, you know, you've got your letter of intent, it appoints you to this position. These are the provisions we use if we notify you of non-renewal. And by the way, if for some reason we really need you to, you know, teach aerospace instead of nursing, you know, we can ask you to teach aerospace. You know, and you understand that. Now, realistically, those paragraphs are going to become very important for some folks, not necessarily at ULM, but for some folks in the very near future, because I can tell you from friends of mine who work at Dillard and Xavier, and I'm not too certain about, actually, and people who work at SUNO, you know, they may have been tenured professors in English, and this year they're on the road trying to recruit high school students so they can start a school year next fall. And that's where one of those blanket paragraphs becomes important, because they may have been an untenured professor in the English department, and their job may have been teaching these three English classes, but this year if you were a teacher at Xavier, Dillard, or SUNO, you're on the road recruiting students so you have somebody to teach next September. And so that's you know, those paragraphs actually are very, very important from the administration standpoint. I should know, we're usually the ones who stick them in there after consulting the administration.
Do you, not necessarily you, but represent faculty? If a faculty member is sued in the course of duties?
I was going to get to that. I wish they had stayed. This is actually very, very important. This is indemnification, and this is the lawyer part, which is why I have the site right at my fingertips. There's a revised statute, Title 13, Section 5108.1. If you're ever curious, if you want to see any of the revised statutes, the quickest way to go is go to the Louisiana Legislature website, which is www.legis.state.la.us. And there's a section in the left that says Louisiana laws. When you click it, you just put in a 13:5108.1, and it'll pull it up. What this is indemnification of public officers and employees of the state, civil rights, and representation by the Attorney General. If you don't remember anything today, this is a lot of what we do. Remember this. If you get sued personally, and you'll know when you get sued because there's only one way to deliver a lawsuit if it's here locally, and that is the sheriff has to put it in your hand. So it'd be no secret when you get sued. If you get sued personally, you have 10 days to transmit that lawsuit to the Attorney General's office and request representation. And that's a very important 10 days. Now, the Attorney General is not obligated to represent you. However, they're supposed to, if they review the suit and the basis of the cause of action took place while the individual was engaged in the performance of the duties of the individual's office or employment with the state. What does that mean? Any ever been in a coverage dispute with your insurance carrier? No. See, I'm talking another language now. Somebody has. basically, if they review the suit and it appears that from the cause of action on the suit that you were acting in the normal course and scope of your duties, whatever your job is, and a lawsuit arose, they refer the suit to risk management, and risk management will assign you a lawyer. And it even says, if you die, the lawyer will continue to represent your heirs and other interests and whatever. Now, if you weren't in the course and scope of your duties, then the Attorney General will evaluate whether you're covered by their lawyer or not. What types of fights do we have over that? Normally, if you've heard me talk before, I spent a lot of time talking about discrimination and sexual harassment. You guys remember those talks I used to give? The reason I spend a lot of time talking about that is if you harass somebody, it's very hard to argue you were in the course and scope of your work as a faculty member. It's very, very hard. I mean, I'd say extraordinarily difficult. You batter somebody, it's hard. I mean, those types of things, the state is going to be reluctant to send you counsel. You know, it's not in the course and scope of your duties. Meanwhile, if you're, you know, just teaching an ordinary class and a student sues you because he thinks he needed an A rather than a B minus, I mean, you were doing what you were supposed to do. You were teaching. That's in the course and scope of your duties. And, you know, those are rather extreme examples, but there's all kinds of examples in the middle that fall on one or the other side of that equation. The most important thing is the 10 days. Now, the University of Louisiana has a policy also. And this is one of those instances where the policies kind of diverge a little bit. This would be great. They get the hand gestures on the camera. The University of Louisiana and the ULM policy, practically what it means is if you get served with a lawsuit, you really need to advise your supervisor and the administration. You still need to send it to the Attorney General, but you need to let the school know also. You should give the school a copy of the suit. Because usually what happens is it means the school's going to get sued also, but service on the school is a little bit different from service on the individual. So you guys will probably get, if you get sued individually, you'll get service before the school will. The school service has to be effected upon the Board of Supervisors in Baton Rouge. Individual services just carry it to the individual. So you should let your supervisor or a dean or somebody in the administration know about it, because what will happen is when you send it to the Attorney General, they will also send a request to the Attorney General indicating that one of their officers or employees has been sued, blah, blah, blah. Please provide counsel, and the Attorney General will evaluate it. So you want to let the school know also. And it happens, I will tell you right now, I personally probably have maybe 10, 12 cases against state institutions, and in half of them, the plaintiff names an individual in addition to the institution. It happens frequently. As I like to joke, you know, you haven't been a college president for any length of time until you've been sued. And then once you become a college president, you usually catch about 4 or 5 a year just because you happen to be president. So that's the rule on indemnification. Really think about the indemnification. There's nothing makes you think about your actions like the indemnification provision, because it really turns on course and scope of your employment. If you aren't acting in the course and scope of your employment, you do something crazy, it happens, you get in a relationship with a student, it goes south, the student sues you in the school, Attorney General does not assign counsel, it's going to be extraordinarily expensive. I mean, extraordinarily expensive. It's not unheard of to spend $150,000, $200,000 on a lawyer for a 2-year civil case involving employment discrimination. She's looking at me like I'm, for the camera, she is looking at me like I'm crazy. So you really want to be careful with that. Okay, moving down. Are the syllabi legally binding? I actually have an answer to this here. We're going through these out of order. Tenure. The syllabi, here we go. The syllabi are not considered legally binding. However, they do produce an expectation within the students as to what's going to be taught, and it may provide an expectation as to how they're going to be evaluated. Now, what does that mean? If your syllabi, for example, establishes an expectation of evaluation, that is, and you see, my most recent school experience was law school, which isn't really relevant. I'm thinking back to my undergrad, which is more relevant. Your syllabi says, my students are going to be evaluated on 4 examinations over the course of the semester, right? And for whatever reason, you know, you decide you're only having 2, and you have a student who missed 1 of the 2, and so suddenly, you know, he only has half the examinations he's expected for his grade, it's going to be a problem. That type of situation will be a problem, because when that student took that class, this syllabi, he was expecting 4, and missing 1 out of 4 is a lot different than missing 1 out of 2. That's the manner in which a syllabi can become binding. On the other hand, when I say generally, it's not in your syllabi. If you list, you know, we're going to study the works of, you know, these 9 authors, and you decide you only want to study 6 and you replace 3 with 3 new ones, that's not a legally binding, that's not the type of change that's going to create a cause of action in somebody. The usual things that can create the expectations that can be binding almost all involve grading. You know, when students have an expectation from the beginning of the semester in the syllabi of being graded in a certain manner, and it flip-flops on them halfway through, it can create an expectation that can cause a problem. So, I was going to give you one example before I take your question. If you would like to use surprise grading methods, such as the occasional pop quiz or the surprise examination or whatever, what do? You just tell them in the syllabi. And then you have an expectation you're going to surprise them. No problems. I mean, if you want to say, you know, we're using 3 formal exams, and I'm going to give occasional quizzes as I see fit, so it's important to be in class, put it in the syllabi. Then when you give the occasional quiz and the student says, I didn't know, it's right there in the syllabi. I'm going to give occasional quizzes, so it's important to come to class. There's no problem with doing that. Now, questions? Yeah. No, I wouldn't say you would have to tell them in advance that, you know, we're going to have 4 exams, they're going to each be graded 20% this one, 30% this one, 50% this one, you know, and 5% this one. Actually, that's 105%, that didn't work. But, you know, you wouldn't have to do that. You could write that and place your students on notice. You may rearrange the course grading structure. However, I would prefer, or actually, it would probably be easier not to place points next to those specific things. You see, what's happening is when you put the points next to the class, you're creating an expectation that this thing is going to be worth this much. And so, being a smart college student, you know, if the thing worth 5 points falls on, you know, the Friday before homecoming, I may be able to sacrifice that one and get the points for all the other ones. So when I skip that one, it should be no big deal. And then at the end of the semester, you send out the thing saying, oh, no, this one's worth 50 points from the Friday before homecoming. That's the problem I don't want you to get into. It would be much easier just to list your grade will be based on these criteria to be evaluated by the instructor. You don't have to say, You don't have to say what percentage each one is going to be based on. You know, that's not, when you create that expectation that this percentage is going to be based on this one, then you've got some obligation to fulfill that expectation. Because students are gonna plan their lives according to the expectation you put out in the syllabi or syllabus. It's easier for the students if you do it that way, but you get to create the expectation in your syllabi. And all I'm saying is you get to define the expectation for that class when you draft your own syllabi. And so in terms of grading, however you list your grading criteria is going to be the expectation students have for your class. So, you know, it's really up to you. There's no legal requirement as to how you have to do it. It's just once you do it, you're creating an expectation for your students. So if you're like one of my professors were, you know, at the beginning of class, we had no syllabi because he was a free thinker. So he said, I will occasionally come to class and give you paper assignments and, you know, you return them throughout the semester and I'll decide what your grade is. That was the expectation. You know, every once in a while we came to class and he gave us a paper assignment. If you didn't come to class that day, you didn't get it. End of story. I mean, you get to define the expectation for your class. And so in that expectation, as you define it, to the extent it involves grading and decisions students are going to make based upon grading, they're going to have that expectation that you fulfill it. You follow?
Right.
You know, basically, you get to define how you want to restrict yourself in grading your class, subject to whatever requirements your department or the school may have for that specific class. Anything else about syllabi? And I'm not telling you can't have freedom with your grading. I'm just saying once you lay down a plan of action for your students as it involves grading, it's going to create an expectation that you follow through with it.
What if you give a participation grade and a student is absent and it's a group activity and you can't call the class into session for that person to make up that participation grade? What do you do with that? The student's absent and miss that daily opportunity.
To me, that sounds like the student's problem.
Yes.
Because did everybody hear the question? What if you give a participation grade for the cameras and the student is absent, so they don't get those participation points, and because it's a group activity, you can't call everybody back in for a special session just so this one student can get the participation grade. To the extent the student knew that that session was going to be a graded session, you don't have to worry about it. It's his.
But even if it's an excused absence, that becomes the problem.
Yeah, it's his. You've created the expectation. You haven't changed anything in that situation. You know, that I wouldn't worry about that from your standpoint. I mean, you have the flexibility to do what you want, but you didn't change the facts. You know, his illness or whatever may have changed the facts. But you followed through with the syllabi as you had it planned. Good question? Yeah.
What if you assign a certain percentage to professionalism and the student comes into the class and they sit in the back and gossip and you subtract a certain amount, or another student comes in and a little dress and you subtract, it's very undefined what professionalism is. And where do you stand with that?
God bless you. God bless you. I think as long as you're clear at the beginning of your class as to what you consider professionalism, your students know what the expectation is and it shouldn't be a problem.
Okay, but if you're not clear and is as loose as
Well, when I say clear, you write down professionalism, I'm sure, on your syllabus or somewhere. You say professionalism will be part of your grade. And when you pass out your syllabus, the ordinary student would expect you to tell them for at least a sentence or two, this is what this professionalism thing means in the syllabus. Once you've done that, you've told them you can expect to be graded on this criteria. And you don't have to worry about, I mean, it's your choice as to how well they did in that criteria. It's actually not that uncommon in you know, certain fields where things like professionalism is really important, like business or MBAs. So I would not think that's a problem unless you failed to explain what your notion of professionalism was when you passed out the syllabus. You know, and be clear that it includes attire. As you can tell, the MBA is real big on that right now also. Anything else? Well, this has been fun. I'm gonna call out these sites. I've got a couple kind of funny cases I usually go through. Some of you have heard these before, but I'm gonna give you these sites one last time so you can look at this stuff.
Can you spend a couple minutes on the only one that I think we skipped is somebody had asked explicitly about nepotism.
Oh, nepotism. I do have the nepotism rule. In fact, I will go through it when I go through these sites. Everyone has program discontinuance. It's PPM. Roman numeral 3, period, Roman numeral 15, XV, period, B hyphen 1. That is the UL policy for program discontinuance. To the extent I may have paraphrased it even slightly different from this policy governs. It's on the internet, and the gist of it is what I explained to you. Program discontinuance in a financial exigency, or without financial exigency, can start internally or externally. Internally, it will be done with input from the faculty. Externally, for the Board of Regents, it may be a little different, but the policy explains exactly how it will work. Chapter 3 of the Board of Regents bylaws is all the information I gave you guys on tenure. And that's the UL system bylaws. Chapter 3 is faculty tenure. Now, section 7 of that bylaw has something you should take a look at. And I may come back to it after nepotism because it often related to nepotism. And that is outside employment by faculty. Other employment while you are working full-time or part-time as a faculty member. And then section 9, which is only two sections later, is what I'm going to talk about here, and that's nepotism. Everybody ready? Nepotism? Nepotism is pretty simple. The board and school policy on nepotism basically say the state ethics code applies as far as nepotism goes with related family members working in the same unit. And the way it works is an immediate family member is one of these people: your children, your spouse, the spouse of your children, brothers and sisters' spouses, your parents, and spouses of parents. Everyone got that? A lot of people it didn't include. So you got children, spouses, siblings, spouses, your spouse, and parents and spouse. Cousins, in-laws, you know, third cousin twice removed, you know, Brother John down the bayou. Obviously they're not included in the nepotism policy. So what does it prevent? It prevents the hiring of an immediate family member in the business unit of the employee. Now that's a loaded statement written by a lawyer. Because what's going to happen is, and And my caveat on nepotism and the state ethics law is you don't want to be the one to make the call on whether one of your immediate family members violates the ethics provision. But generally, you've got to define a unit. And defining the unit is where the nepotism rules are. I mean, that's where the real crux of this matter is. If a hiring is prohibited by the state ethics code, then you know that hiring or business relation or contract or whatever it may be is prohibited for 2 years after the family member who is employed by the public agency, their employment's over. So you often hear it as the two-year bar. If you can't hire your immediate relative into this position right now, then they can't take it for 2 years after you're through with your employment. Same way with a contract. You know, if your unit can't contract with a family member right now, they can't contract them with for 2 years after you finish with your employment. The interesting thing is the definition of business unit. Business unit, you have to look at like a sort of like a pyramid. If you're the dean of a department, or you're the head of a department in the School of Music, let's say, who's the dean of the School of Music? Who's the dean of arts and sciences?
Carlos Fandel.
Dean what?
Fandel.
Fandel? Okay, so is he here? Is she here?
No, he's not here.
I hate to pick on it, but it's too bad. Dean Fandel, if you watch this, we're picking on you. But let's say Dean Fandel is the dean of arts and sciences, right? And just as a hypothetical, it would mean the people defined as his immediate family member would not be able to be hired anywhere under the umbrella of arts and sciences, whatever departments, divisions, whatever it includes. It doesn't necessarily mean that if his wife or child, you know, is actually a great baseball coach, if the athletic department interviewed him and hired him as a baseball coach, that might not violate the ethics code. That's not his unit. His unit is arts and sciences. So whether he does the hiring or somebody under him does the hiring, his relatives are prohibited from working or contracting with arts and sciences. Now, it gets much trickier as you move up the pyramid, because you have, like, you know, who's the vice president for business affairs and finance?
Dave Nichols,
right? His pyramid is much, much larger. So he has to look at his unit like everything that falls under the purview of business affairs and finance. And if you go to somebody like Dr. Kofer, which, you know, for most university presidents, it's extraordinarily difficult for them to have any family members employed at the institution in which they're president, because their pyramid is effectively the entire campus.
So,
long-term,
I work faculty before he's hired.
That's the exception. Oh, yo, done this before, huh? There's what's called the one-year exception. If you held a job for 1 year prior to the hiring of someone, then there's an exception under the ethics code. It would be sort of like, now it's not under, because I know you're trying to figure out, you know, how this fits together. It would be, for example, if Dr. Kofer had a wife who taught music, right? And the UL board selected Dr. Kofer as president of the campus. If his wife had been teaching here greater than 1 year before he was selected as president of the campus, she could remain in her position as a music teacher, or let's say music teacher, music professor. If she had been here less than 1 year, for him to become president, she'd have to resign as a music professor. But once he becomes president, his wife could never take a position as a faculty member on this campus. And the only reason is, you know, as you know, in the University of Louisiana system and most of our state schools, different people pop up at different state schools. And when you look at state government, basically when you read the law, you see that you don't want to penalize somebody who's usually had a career in one department just because one of their relatives popped up above them on the food chain, so to speak. So that's the exception.
Could she be promoted?
That would be a problem. Now, it says that she should not. It says that if you, in that exception, that person should not be discriminated against because of that relation in promotion, advancement, or raises. But you also get into this conflicts problem with authority and reporting to. And so she could be promoted, but the problem is the dean would raise her one step closer to the president in the reporting chain, and you have to keep that conflicts issue from happening. For example, if she was the women's baseball coach and the system wanted Dr. Kofor as the the athletic director, you know, and they appointed Dr. Kofor athletic director, odds are she'd have to transfer someone because she couldn't report to her. You know, she wouldn't have to resign, but you can't report to an immediate family member, even if you fit within that exception. That's a conflict. I'd have to understand how that arose. I'd really have to look at that, because then you get there are some exceptions. It happens, but I just have to look at historically how the situation arose before I can say that automatically couldn't happen. Because you do have people who've been in places 20 and 30, and there are actually some faculty members in some schools have been there 35 years. And so I would have to look at it before I said that wouldn't work. Anything else?
I teach interior design, and my students each semester for a studio class go out into the community and assist a client, have a real client experience.
Okay. No, that's a pretty good release. Do they get class credit for the assignment, or does the client employ them?
No, they get class credit for it, and any materials that they recommend have to be ordered through a business in town. You know, we don't do any of that. We just make
the client makes the order, and they go straight. The materials go straight to the client.
And they get offense rechecked. But I mean, I'm more concerned with like an auto accident or something out there.
No, that's not any different from any student taking any other field trip or the nursing school students going to a local hospital to do their internship. I wouldn't worry about that. That's a neat program, though. Okay, moving forward. Everyone understand nepotism? Okay. I think that's everything in this list. You got the three sites I called out. There were a couple more I wanted to give you. The last site I called out was Section 9, which was nepotism, under Chapter 3 of the UL Bylaws. Section 11 is tenure, and in that section is termination of tenure for financial exigency. And Section 16 are the rules for declaring a financial exigency. And then you all have access to your local faculty handbook, which basically has, your local faculty handbook has a rule for each of those topics as it applies to the particular campus, and to the extent the rule may differ, the UL policy will govern. Now, last but not least, on to more exciting legal issues. Anything else about contracts, handbooks, termination, program elimination, or reduction in force?
You started earlier and you had to stop and go back to the faculty handbook issue. We were going to talk about termination of a non-tenured faculty
member. Yeah, okay. I thought I had mentioned that. Termination of non-tenured faculty member. The only rights that non-tenured faculty member has is the notice provision, which is 3 months or 6 months notice, depending on how long they've had their contract.
What about tenured faculty in a program discontinuation?
They have this provision that I just called out in program discontinuance. which states, and I actually corrected myself, tenured faculty members will have 1 year's notice of a program discontinuance. It's 1 year's notice of a program discontinuance. There is no guaranteed notice for a financial exigency. But there's, when I say there's no guaranteed notice, there's no minimum notice period. There is a guaranteed notice of a declaration of financial exigency. But there's no minimum period for the financial exigency. So it clarifies termination for non-tenured, termination for tenured. Okay. Anything else regarding termination or employment security? Go ahead.
Just a question. You said with your review for tenure by peers and for promotion by peers, we've had a person dismissed with no discussion to the department nor the college.
Okay. Were they tenured?
No, they were first year and they were doing an excellent job.
Okay, that's one of the things that I thought was clear. If you're not tenured,
they can do that, but wouldn't you assume they at least talk to the dean or the department head?
I can't assume. I can tell you what they're entitled to under the policies. And the only thing a non-tenured faculty member is entitled to under the policy
is the
3 or 6 month notice. That's the only thing. Now, you know, between most of you, I assume, are tenured. Between you tenured faculty members, that policy is to protect the tenured ones, because you don't have to go through a financial exigency to send that notice to your untenured faculty. And it's that way on purpose. Because if there's a financial exigency, one of the policies is the school will look at both tenured faculty, untenured faculty, and seniority in determining, you know, what to do. And they don't have as many rights as tenured faculty because there may need to be more flexibility in dealing with untenured faculty than tenured faculty. So it's a give and take. And you know, that's what they're entitled to. Anything else on terminations? Okay. I've got to cover this. I know I'm running over by about 30 minutes. One last thing. This is becoming a bigger and bigger and bigger issue. Anybody heard of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act? You've heard of it? Okay, every time I come to campus, I got to mention something new so you guys can feel like I didn't repeat the same stuff I said the last. Now it's going to be the last three times. Digital Millennium Copyright Act. It, along with the standard copyright laws, is becoming something it's not quite as big as discrimination or harassment or any of the big things we talk about. However, I need to pull out my copyright notes here. However, it is becoming a problem with, how shall we say it, with the use of servers and shared course materials and the ability to put bulk materials on some sort of web space for your students to access without even having to use a Kinko's, so to speak, is causing copyright issues to become a problem. So to back up and start at the beginning, everyone, I'm assuming, understands the whole fair use copyright rules, that if you want to copy something for your class to use, there are certain rules you can look at, you know, how much of the total work are you copying, what's it doing to the market of the total work, is it for classroom use, is it for some commercial use, and from that you can decide, is it safe to copy these 20 pages and tell my students pick it up, or should I make them buy the book, okay? The Digital Millennium Copyright Act basically takes all those rules, right, and sort of melds them into electronic transmission. So all those same questions you ask yourself about whether you can copy something and say, I'm leaving this at the local copy shop, go pick it up rather than buy the book. And when you go through that little internal checklist in your head, you're satisfied, I don't have to make them buy the book because I'm not using enough of it or whatever. You've got to do the same test if you're going to hyperlink it or put it somewhere where your students are going to access it online. Unless, of course, the online site says this is free for educational use. You follow? The way you put the data out there for your students doesn't alter whether the copyright rules apply. Now there's a, and I've got a thing here. And I've got a test here. Now, there's a safe harbor provision in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and it basically says that the institution isn't going to be liable for, I guess, copyright infringing transmissions if all it acts is as a conduit with its server. It's not the person on the other end doing the improper transmission or I guess, which we call it, download. And it's not the person on the front end sending the improper transmission to the download. The institution has this sort of limited protection if it's just the conduit. Except there's a test on whether that limited protection applies. And one of the things is the activity that the institution wants the protection from cannot involve the provision of online access to instructional materials. You follow? So there's this institutional protection, and I'll give you an example. The institutional protection arose out of the Napster case. Students were going on, you know, schools were the first to have these high-speed servers. Students were going on to download tons and tons of music very, very fast through these high-speed servers at institutions. The institutions didn't want to be liable. So they got this protection built into the law, except the law put an exception. That protection does not apply to the access of instructional materials. Meaning, what does that mean? If you don't run through that little test in your head when you put up potentially copyrighted materials on an institution server or use an institution server to transmit copyrighted materials, you don't have that protection. I mean, those copyright violations are going to be the same as if you copied an entire work and left it at Kinko's just because you didn't want your students to buy it. And so that's kind of, a lot of people probably don't spend a lot of time thinking about it, but that's kind of the stuff us academic lawyers think about, are the things that are a couple years down the road. We think this is going to be a big deal a couple years down the road, because if you've been following the Chronicle, MIT was the first university in the country to put all course materials free online for every student. You can go to MIT and not pick up a page, a physical page. Every course material for every class has to be made available on their web server. So you wonder, that means some lawyer had to do a lot of dealing with a lot of publishers to figure out what the equivalent for selling all of those books was, because now they just put a link on their website and they're there. That's a lot of work. Other institutions like ULM need to start thinking about that as it becomes easier to say, don't pick up the copy at Kinko's, don't buy the book. I put the book here on the website, you know, just log into UL server and you can read the chat.
I didn't realize that MIT that replaced textbooks. I thought it was just all other supplemental.
No, they've done it for every class they offer.
But so they don't buy textbooks.
You can, but you don't have to. You don't have to. I was reading in the Chronicle, they made every material required for every class available online. It was an experiment. And it cost them, it cost them like $8 or $10 million a year for the space to do it. Because you figure that's a lot of instructional materials you gotta make. And whether you use Acrobat format or whatever, I mean, that's just a lot of web space. But they did it. And they were hoping other schools would follow suit, but when other schools saw what MIT was paying, they were kind of like, oh, tell us how the experiment works. So that's, I just wanted to raise that copyright issue, because that's, he's laughing, yeah, it's very expensive. it's a very big deal.
Well, how really are you going to tell if you're violating? I mean, if it doesn't have a notice saying this is copyrighted material.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. Here is how you tell. I actually have it.
I mean, it's all out there.
there, you know, post it publicly.
Write these three things down. This is literally, you literally want to know how you tell? There's a four-part test the court looks at in determining if you're violating the copyright of a work. And basically, you have to assume every work is copyrighted. I mean, that's a given. You know, unless it says on the front, free for all, every work is copyrighted. You look at the purpose and character of the use, including whether such use is of a commercial nature or nonprofit educational purpose. That's your first test. Is it for commercial or educational use? The second test is the nature of the copyrighted work.
The nature of it.
The nature of it. The third test is the portion you're copying in relation to the total work. And the third test is the value of, well, the effect of your copying on the market for that work. It's actually pretty simple. And you look at, when you go to copy something like this, you know, this service, right, probably runs this, I don't know, $10,000-$15,000 a year, you know, to get these little, you know, $2 pamphlets show up at the office. Books are extraordinarily expensive. Any of you work in a library, you'll know that. If I copy this, right, this whole thing, and I make it available to, I teach a CLE for lawyers. I make it available to lawyers attending a CLE on education law. You know, what have I done to the market for this education law service for this month? I mean, well, for this month, nobody's going to need to buy it. But the question is, have I affected the market? Because it's only useful if you get it, actually it comes every 2 weeks. If you get it every 2 weeks, it's not useful just to get a one-month picture of it out of an entire year.
But if it's already online and it's not a paid service, you can give the URL to your students
and
tell them where it is. Anybody can go read it. How's that?
But the problem is if it's online and it's copyrighted, you're just furthering somebody else's. If it's not online with the original publisher, you may be furthering somebody else's violation of the copyright, which doesn't insulate you any better just because you say, this guy stole it and posted it. Go look at his posting. You know, that doesn't forgive you from violating the copyright. I mean,
it's an art image from the Tate Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
It's there.
Yeah, no, I know. And that's one of those things where, you know, you're going to look at it. Is anybody going to sue you? No. Maybe. I mean, I can't absolutely say no, but it would be highly unlikely for just looking at an image. Generally with images, though, most images have been posted on the internet with permission, and there's usually the little thing at the bottom that says, you know, for educational purposes or personal use only. If there's an image from an art gallery, I can promise you whoever posted it has permission to post that particular image. The bigger problem is works, poetry, novels, you know, textbooks, chunks of textbooks, things like that. You know, if somebody copies a particular book, or even a particular Cliff Notes, and says, oh, I've got the Cliff Notes on my personal website over here. You want to see the Cliff Notes, just go to my website. You know, if you send those students to the website, you're furthering the copyright infringement. You know, and that's a problem. Yeah?
Well, I was just going to go to another topic.
Okay, go ahead.
But before you leave, would you just touch on post-tenure review, because I think that was a question some people talking about and wanting to know. So just give us a brief.
I'm going
to
dodge you real quick. Yeah, I'm going to go. I think this is copyright.
Yes,
okay.
This is copyright. What about videotapes that you would normally you purchase to show in the classroom and just for the sake of time, you put it on Blackboard, for instance, the website?
You really have to look at the And when you open the little videotape, either on the box or when you unwrap the shrink wrap, there's going to be a little thing saying what you've purchased it for.
Well, we have another program on campus called Tegrity that was specifically purchased in order to copy videotapes to put on Blackboard. So
no, actually, I'm talking about the videotape. You see, the videotape, when you buy the videotape is going to have a use. You probably, yeah, my guess is you probably threw it away, but the videotape is going to have a little use thing in it. It'll say, you know, this is to be used. It'll be either strictly by the purchaser or for educational use only. It'll have a restriction. If your Blackboard fits within the restriction, you can post it on your Blackboard. It may depend on who has access to your Blackboard. Because if your Blackboard is just campus access, I would say that would fit within the educational use. If your Blackboard has greater than campus access, then you look at what has that posting done to the market for that videotape, and you've really eliminated it for anybody who has access to the Blackboard, and I would say you probably can't put it up there. You see what's happening? You know, if you had a way to post it and it's restricted to for viewing to the class you were going to show it to or the department you were going to show it to, or even if you could do it just to the school, it would be one thing. If you post it and it's viewable by others than the school, you're taking away the market for that videotape. And that's why they made the tape. So, you know, I would say you wouldn't be able to post it in that instance. Post-tenure review. I'm not going to be able to speak to post-tenure review because that's a very, very hot. Post-tenure review. I did not look up the rules for post-tenure review, so I'm going to avoid that right now. I can tell you that it's a very hot topic right now, and I would expect that post-tenure review to become something much more important than it's been in the past in the next several years.
So is there any policy yet? Can you tell me that? I mean, is there a written?
I'm not aware of a written.
Because we were wondering if there was.
Of a written policy for post-tenure review right now. The reason I'm not going to really dive into it is if you follow, you know, education nationally, a lot of schools are looking at redoing the traditional notion of tenure. And some schools in this state, both public and private, have looked at, you know, really placed a long, hard, scrutinizing look at the whole tenure process and what tenure means and maintaining it. And post-tenure review is a part of that right now, which is why it's being discussed, but I really just can't go into it.
Anything else? Thank you very much.
No problem. We are done.